the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. A school in Maine has decided that it is appropriate to offer contraceptives to 11 through 13-year-olds. That's in a middle school near Portland, Maine. The decision came down last night. The school board deciding to go ahead with the proposal. It's creating a lot of controversy nationwide, but of course it's a part of a much larger pattern. At my website at albertmohler.com overnight, I posted an article on parental rights in education. You see, the big deal, a part of the real scandal of what's going on in Portland, Maine, is that these children will be under no obligation to inform their parents, and the school will not inform the parents that their own children, ages 11, 12, and 13, are seeking and obtaining contraceptives. Parental rights in education are a fundamental to a free society. I mean, that's the bottom line. You really do not have a free society if parents do not have the right to determine the education of their children. We're going to be talking about this today, and we're going to have as our special guest Jeff Jacoby, who's a columnist for the Boston Globe. He has written an outstanding essay on this problem, to which I provide a link at my website, and we'll be talking with him in just a few moments. We'll be getting to this issue. We want you to join the conversation. I can't imagine there's a parent who doesn't have a stake in this and doesn't understand that if we do not contend for and exercise vigilance in the defense of parental rights in education, we will lose it, and we will lose something fundamental to our responsibility as parents and to what it means to have a free society. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll also be talking about why Christian parents have a particular stake in this controversy. That coming up in just a moment. First, to review some issues in the news. With the 2008 presidential race heating up, there are some big developments. Yesterday, the news was that Bob Jones University Chancellor, Bob Jones III, had offered an endorsement of Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney. What makes that, of course, so newsworthy is that Mitt Romney is a Mormon, not just any Mormon, a former Mormon bishop, very much a Mormon. And it looks like Mitt Romney, the former Massachusetts governor, is getting more comfortable running as a Mormon. And some evangelicals, at least, are looking at the options on the Republican side, and they're deciding that he is the one who is most likely to be able to protect evangelical interests. There are some on the other side of this argument as well. Now, it's interesting that the argument that Bob Jones III made is not that Mormonism is acceptable. As a matter of fact, he comes out and says very clearly these words. He says, as a Christian, I'm completely opposed to the doctrines of Mormonism, but I'm not voting for a preacher. I'm voting for a president. It boils down to who can best represent conservative American beliefs, not religious beliefs. And that's a very interesting argument. As a matter of fact, I was interviewed on the Hugh Hewitt program yesterday. And I mentioned that if you are going to have this kind of argument, this is the best way to make the argument, that we are electing a political leader, we have defined political goals, and we're not electing someone on the basis of his specific faith commitments, his religious commitments, in this case his Mormon commitments, but rather we're electing him on the basis of what he will do in office or what he pledges and we believe is likely that he will do in office. And just the very same day that that came out, evangelical theologian Wayne Grudem of Phoenix Theological Seminary, a well-known evangelical author, also released a statement on why evangelicals should support Mitt Romney, making some similar arguments, pointing also to the former Massachusetts governor's experience. But on the other side, there are those who are not ready to do this at all, and included in that side of the ledger would be the new pastor of the First Baptist Church of Dallas, Texas, the Reverend Dr. Robert Jeffress. He said this, Mitt Romney is a Mormon, and don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Even though he talks about Jesus as his Lord and Savior, he is not a Christian. Mormonism is not Christianity. Mormonism is a cult. Now, as he goes on, Dr. Jeffress says, what really distresses me is some of my ministerial friends and even leaders in our convention, he's speaking there of the Southern Baptist Convention, are saying, oh, well, he talks about Jesus. We talk about Jesus. What's the big deal? He said, it's a big deal if anybody names another way to be saved except through Jesus Christ. Now, I'm not sure exactly where all that's coming from. I'm certainly not hearing anyone say that Mormonism is not a big deal. But what we're talking about here is whether or not Christians, evangelicals in particular, can vote for a Mormon for president. As a matter of fact, Dr. Jeffers seems to acknowledge that it might be possible for a person to vote for, a Christian to vote for Mitt Romney. but not for Mormonism. And that's going to be the interesting quandary for an awful lot of evangelical Christians. It's going to be interesting to think that through. Now, if you're looking for resources on whether Mormonism is a version of Christianity, go to my website. I was engaged in a lengthy debate with Mormon leader and author Orson Scott Card at BeliefNet.com just a few weeks ago. That's still up. My argument is, of course, Mormonism is not a form of Christianity. It is indeed an anti-Christianity. But does that settle the issue as to whether an evangelical could vote for Mitt Romney for president? I suggest those are two separate questions. And one of the realities we face in the 2008 presidential race is that evangelicals are going to have to grow up somewhat and rethink some of these basic issues, because we don't have the kind of easy choice that evangelicals felt they have had in recent election cycles. And we're going to have to figure out how to handle all this. The rise of the new militant atheists, especially figures such as Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, and Richard Dawkins. This is getting a lot of attention in the media. And it also has the attention now of the leader of the Church of England, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. Now, I want to bring attention to how the Archbishop of Canterbury has responded to Richard Dawkins. Now, let's remember what's at stake here. Richard Dawkins is a militant atheist who suggests, among other things, that it is irrational to believe in God, that those who believe in God are believing in a delusion, that this delusion is a dangerous delusion that inevitably leads to violence. He also argues that it is a form of child abuse, that parents would have control over the religious upbringing of their children. So it looks like you couldn't possibly come up with an atheistic argument that Richard Dawkins is unwilling to press. You would think that the leader of the Church of England, after all, would release a forceful response to this. And I do not mean to make fun of the Archbishop of Canterbury, but this is exactly how he responded to Richard Dawkins, as is reported in major newspapers. This is The Guardian, one of the major newspapers in London. I'm going to quote here the Archbishop of Canterbury. Quote, "There are specific areas of mismatch between what Dawkins may write about and what religious people think they are doing," end quote. Now, let me point out that Dr. Dawkins, Professor Dawkins, who's a professor at Oxford University, at least says clearly what he means. He clearly denies the existence of God. He suggests that those who believe in God are delusional. He says that this delusion is dangerous. And the response to that, well, let's just say it's not so clear. From the leader of the Church of England, it comes out, these are specific areas, or there are specific areas of mismatch between what Dawkins may write about and what religious people think they are doing. Let me just suggest that the biblical principle to let your yea be a yea and your nay be nay is to point us toward the clarity we should have to be able to respond to something like this in a coherent sense. It's clear in some weird sense that the Archbishop of Canterbury doesn't agree with one of the most militant atheists of the day. I guess it shouldn't be headline news that the leader of the Church of England disagrees with Britain's most notorious atheist. The problem is the atheist is very clear about why he is an atheist. The theist in this case is anything but clear about why he is a theist. Other things going on in the news, by the way. Last week we were talking about the Council of Europe and the fact that it was listing creationism, the belief in creation science or the belief in a divine creation of the world, as being a threat to human rights. Hard to believe. I posted an article on that. And when I say it's hard to believe, I really mean that. It is hard to believe. I wrote the article just last week, and it still seems very strange to me that the leading human rights organization, the official body that is the Court of Human Rights in Europe, came to the conclusion that belief in a divine creation of the universe is a threat to human rights. Well, they're at it again. The Council of Europe, according to the press, has designated its first European Day against the death penalty. And that is this very week, the first European Day against the death penalty. This is over the objections of Poland, which wanted the day to officially condemn abortion as well. Krzysztof Bozak, a Polish delegate to the Council of Europe, said, "If we are to discuss life issues, let's be honest and not hypocritical. It's not the death penalty, but abortion and euthanasia that kill millions of innocent European citizens every year." Now, why would he say that? He says that because it's transparently true. The Council of Europe has come out against something that no European country that is a member of the Council is actually practicing. And this, too, is a form of hypocrisy. Whatever you believe about the death penalty, you have to believe that the European nations right now are in a situation of gross hypocrisy. They point to the United States, which practices the death penalty, at least to some extent, and they suggest that it's backward and barbaric. But poll after poll after poll indicates that a majority of the citizens of European countries support the death penalty. One member of the Council of Europe, speaking in the press this past week, said, that's why we don't have a direct democracy, because if we did, we would have the death penalty in Europe as well. I really appreciate this Polish leader who pointed out that what's really killing people in Europe is not the death penalty, but abortion and euthanasia. You're not going to see the Council of Europe come out against that. And that, as this Polish leader says, is a form of gross moral hypocrisy. Back to talk about parental authority, parental rights, and the education of children, and to talk about why a middle school in Maine thinks it's appropriate to pass out contraceptives to kids, even without the knowledge of their parents. The phone number is 877-893-8255, and I'm Albert Moeller. Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. It's amazing how some of these things come together. But in the course of about 48 hours, columnist Jeff Jacoby of the Boston Globe published an article on parental rights in education and made a very forceful argument. I thought a brilliant piece, frankly. And then within 24 hours, you have a school board in Maine voting to authorize contraceptives to be given to 11, 12, and 13-year-olds without the knowledge of their parents. Parental rights in education are, I would argue, fundamental to a free society. A similar argument is made by Jeff Jacoby. We're honored to have him with us on the program today. Mr. Jacoby, welcome.
Great to talk to you.
Listen, I really enjoyed your piece, and I really like the way you started it. I'm going to give this quote with which you begin your column in the Boston Globe. Sure. Freedom of education, being an essential of civil and religious liberty, must not be interfered with under any pretext whatever. We are opposed to state interference with parental rights and rights of conscience in the education of children as an infringement of the fundamental doctrine that the largest individual liberty consistent with the rights of others ensures the highest type of American citizenship and best government. Is that coming from some kind of a far-right wacko outfit?
Yeah, you might think it was from the Libertarian Manifesto or maybe the Barry Goldwater Republican Convention of 1964. In fact, that language is taken from the Democratic Party platform of 1892. As these political platforms always do, they have one paragraph after another dealing with different topics. And the education plank in the 1892 Democratic platform, although it saluted support for public schools, went on to make the point that when it comes to the education of kids, parental rights have to be supreme, have to be paramount. I'm no scholar of educational politics in the 19th century. My understanding is that much of the push to get as many American kids into public schools, government-run schools, as possible, came in response to the rise of the Catholic community in this country and the determination by an awful lot of Catholic parents to give their kids a Catholic education. That didn't meet with the approval of a lot of the mainstream Protestant culture, and the push to bring as many kids as possible into government schools was one result. Catholics were very strong in the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party made a point of saying parents' freedom of conscience and freedom of educating their children has to be more important and regarded as more important than what the government wants kids to know and to learn.
Yeah, Mr.
But
Jacoby,
unfortunately, that attitude seems to be long gone today.
It's interesting you draw that historical parallel. Actually, it goes on beyond that into the 20th century as well with John Dewey and the ideal of what he called the common school. And that was not a Protestant vision, but a very secular vision, an explicitly secular vision. And you're right to point to Catholicism as one of the main things, but it wasn't just Catholicism. It was the ethnicity of the Catholics. There are Polish Catholics and German Catholics and Italian Catholics and Irish Catholics. And the vision of the government-run school was that it would be a place into which these children would come and be separated from the tradition of their patrimony and the biases and prejudices, Dewey said, of their parents, and they would be made into new citizens. So the common school became kind of a government-run factory for producing citizens. You and your own argument are saying that's pretty much what it became.
Which you would think Americans would have gotten their backs up against. What could more strongly fly in the face of the American tradition of liberty and the right of individuals to make their own choice and to choose their own way in the world, than the idea that the government should be putting everybody through a cookie-cutter educational system in which they're all trained to think the same and have the same values and come out spouting the same ideas. But we've gotten to the point now where more than 90% of American children are educated in government-run schools. All of us, of course, are taxed to pay for those schools. Parents who want to put their kids in private schools or parochial schools or who want to homeschool their children are required to make tremendous personal sacrifices or financial sacrifices in order to do it. And it just strikes me that that we are a long way from where we ought to be when it comes to the rights of parents to educate their children and the rights of kids to grow up to be free citizens.
You know, one of the biggest demographic movements in America over the last generation has been the homeschooling movement.
Right.
I really believe if it had not started when it did and gained a momentum, it'd be very difficult to start it now.
I don't know the history of it. I'm not sure when it did begin, but everything that I've seen suggests that the numbers are growing year by year. I think we've got something like 2 million kids.
Yeah, I think the interesting historical moment was that it began when there was a much clearer affirmation in the culture of parental rights. I think that this right to which you point so eloquently in your column has been neglected for so long that I think a lot of parents simply aren't as concerned, alarmed as they should be on this.
Well, and it was a particular incident of that triggered my interest in writing this column. This is about the fourth or fifth that I've done on the idea of separating school and state. What triggered this one was a moment in the Democratic presidential debate that took place a few weeks ago at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. The moderator asked the candidates about an episode that had taken place here in Massachusetts, in Lexington, Massachusetts, a few months ago. A second grade teacher in the public elementary school made a point of reading a storybook to her students that celebrated and championed same-sex marriage. It was a book called King and King about two princes who fall in love and get married. Quite, written at a second grader's level, but quite positive and upbeat in portraying same-sex marriage. It became, as you might imagine, something of a controversy. A lot of parents were, or at least a number of parents, were upset about it. Some of them went to court, and their case was basically thrown out by the judge that says public schools have a right to teach whatever they want. Parents do not have a right to interfere with that. The moderator in the Democratic debate asked the candidates whether they were comfortable with that. And it was John Edwards' answer that really got my goat. He was asked, are you comfortable with this? And he says, yes, absolutely. I want my children to be exposed to all the information, even in second grade. I don't want to impose my view. Nobody made me God. I don't get to decide on behalf of my family or my children. I don't get to impose on them what it is that I believe is right. And I was just struck by the idea of a grown, sentient American adult saying that as a parent, it shouldn't be up to him to try to shape the values and ideas that are inculcated in his kids.
You know,
it should be the government that does it through the public school.
Well, let's just flip that question. I have a feeling that if you ask that question about his children being taught creation science in the public schools, you get a very different response.
Yes, that's probably true. Or any of the topics that the left gets so exercised about. But in a way, if you would find him insisting that those were not appropriate to be taught in school, you'd find other people saying that they absolutely ought to be taught in public school. And my idea is that none of this is appropriate in a free society. Parents should have the greatest possible freedom to make educational decisions for their kids. And if there are parents who want their children to attend schools in which they are taught strict Darwinian evolution without any reference to God, they should be able to do so. And if there are parents who want to make sure that their kids grow up seeing God's hand in the glories of the universe, they should be able to do that too. And the idea that these kinds of controversies and subjects that so passionately divide so many parents are somehow going to all be compromised and worked out in a public school system, it seems to me is just crazy. But trying to get past that 90% barrier of parents who, you know, mostly don't think of doing it any other way is really the challenge that we face.
Our guest today is Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe. I would refer you to his article. You can go to my website at albertmohler.com. That's MOHLER.com. Find my article posted this morning, Parental Rights in Education, Constant Vigilance Needed. And you can find a link to the Boston Globe and to his column. When we come back, are we talking about what happened just hours after this column ran in the Boston Globe? Just up the coast in Maine, a school district decided that it's entirely appropriate and within governmental authority to pass out contraceptives through a health clinic to 11, 12, and 13-year-olds without the knowledge of their parents. What will be the catalyst to wake up some of America's parents? Back with that in just a moment.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
In his recent column at the Boston Globe, Jeff Jacoby asked the question of how America's political parties, the Democrats in particular, but to some extent also the Republicans, have gone from parties that supported parental support and education to, as he cited candidate John Edwards, suggesting that parents have no right to impose their values upon the public school system, even as we realize the public school system is very much about imposing values upon children. Jeff Jacoby's our guest today. Mr. Jacoby, I want to ask you a question. What in the world explains what happened in Maine? That appears to add a new question to your question.
Well, this is just unbelievable. It's a middle school in Portland, Maine, that has apparently announced that it's going to be providing birth control pills to girls as young as 11 years old. And as far as I know, they're going to be doing this without getting parental approval or parental consent beforehand. You know, at one level, this is just political correctness run amok. This notion that the way you keep kids safe and healthy is not by encouraging them through the words that you use and the models, the examples that you set to abstain from having sex, but rather by giving them as much information as possible and even giving them sex aids to make sure that they can do it whenever they're ready for it. But 11 years old, I'm no expert on Maine law, but I'm pretty sure that even in Maine, it's illegal to have sex with an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old. So in effect, it seems to me, this school is not only trampling right over the right of parents to be able to have some say in this, but they're also encouraging and abetting illegal activity.
You know, a columnist at your competitive paper there in Boston, the Boston Herald, wrote that this is a moment that captures all the logic of New England liberalism. It certainly appears to be. And as a matter of fact, I'm looking at the actual policy here. And according to the Associated Press and the documents that are related, parents are not going to have the authority once they sign that their children can participate in the school health program. That's the only place where they get an opt-out, is with the entire health program. But if they do sign them up for the health program, then the kids will be able to get contraceptives, and the school will not release this to parents. Now, one of the interesting things here is that the kid can be suspended for taking an aspirin. But
right,
they're going to be passing out contraceptives.
Right. Schools with these zero tolerance policies,
right,
where if you, so much as use a crayon to draw a picture of a gun, you can get suspended. Or if your parent sends you to school with, some Tylenol in your purse and they catch you with it, you can be kicked out. But they're going to give out birth control pills to 11-year-old girls. There's something seriously demented about it. And I think it just reinforces the point that you and I were talking about before. This is in part what can happen when a nation is convinced that its children are supposed to be put into the control of the government and government agents for the shaping of their values and the molding of their minds. This is the further fallout from the sexual revolution of recent decades. It was one thing when the attitude was that on college campuses, people should be as sexually unfettered and free as they wanted to be. But in time, it trickles down even to the middle schools of Portland, Maine. I would like to think that this is the kind of craziness that will finally set the pendulum moving back in the other direction. But if we've learned anything lately, it's not to be optimistic that way.
And you're writing about this not only as a columnist right there on the front lines of this kind of debate, but as a parent,
a
father.
Sure. I'm a parent. I have two boys who are 10 and 4 years old. I live in Brookline, Massachusetts, which, is often described as having a great public school system. And when I meet people or have conversations with people and they find out where I live, they'll sometimes make a comment like, oh, well, you'll never have to worry about your kids getting a good education. And I tell them, yeah, that's right, because the last place I would consider putting them is in the control of the Massachusetts Teachers Association. My family is Jewish, and my kids go to a Jewish day school. That's the kind of upbringing that I had, and I hope it's the kind of upbringing that when they're grown and have children, they will see to it that their kids have. But, meanwhile, like all other residents and homeowners, I'm helping to pay for the education of my neighbor's kids through my property taxes. And I've been hearing from people all day today and yesterday, ever since this column came out, saying, I would love to get my kids into a private school, but I can't possibly afford it. And for a lot of people, that barrier seems insuperable. As long as they've got to pay thousands of dollars in taxes,
absolutely,
they can't imagine how they're going to find the money to pay for a private education for their kids themselves.
Jeff Jacoby is one of my favorite columnists. He writes for the Boston Globe. You can find his columns by going to www.boston.com. Go to the opinion page, and you'll be able to find an archive of his columns as well. Mr. Jacoby, thank you for joining us today.
A great pleasure, Dr. Mueller. Thank you.
All right, folks, now is the time for you to join the conversation. Call us at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Are you ready to talk about a parent's rights in education? Or let's put it this way, are you ready for someone else to say you don't have the right to make these choices? Back with your conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I'd love to know what you think about this. You have a school district in Maine selecting a middle school to be the first middle school in that state, and so far as I know, at least at this point, in the country, to be passing out contraceptives to 11, 12, and 13-year-olds. And you're talking about a situation in which a lot of these kids aren't even in puberty yet, and they're being handed contraceptives without the knowledge of their parents. And we are told that the parents don't have the right to that knowledge. Jeff Jacoby, our guest from the Boston Globe, was talking about the fact that you've got Democratic candidates saying that they don't want to impose their values to the public schools. Well, that's exactly what the public schools do, is impose values. And just to be very clear that this is a bipartisan problem, you also have on the Republican side a good many people who are so intimidated by the educational establishment that they're not about to buck this. They're not about to draw attention to this problem. But if we don't, who will? And let's realize we're talking about a place, just as Mr. Jacoby said, where 90% of America's children are to be found. You know, Willie Loman, the bank robber, was once asked why he robbed banks. He famously said, that's where the money is. Why do these people attach so much attention to the schools? Because that's where the future is. That's where the children are. And we need to recognize that they are targets of those who have an agenda. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I'd really love to hear from you because this is something that ought to have parents apoplectic, upset, ready to talk, ready to do something. I'm right with Mr. Jacoby and wondering what in the world will wake up an awful lot of parents. Several times on this program, I've talked about the history of how we got to this place. And the history is not only John Dewey and his vision of the common school to separate children from the prejudices of their parents, but, of course, also politically speaking, the teachers' unions, which have enormous power. There was an article that came out after the 2004 Democratic National Convention indicating that one of three delegates at that convention was either a member of the National Education Association or married to a member of the National Education Association, the NEA as it's most commonly known. That ought to tell you something about the power of that group within the Democratic Party. On the Republican side, there is not the same kind of links to the teachers' unions, and for good reason, but you do have, nonetheless, the fact that when Ronald Reagan was elected president of the United States in 1980, he ran at least on a platform that was to eliminate the Department of Education. He made the argument as a candidate that it is wrong for the federal government to have a Department of Education. It'll be left to the states, and it should not be a federal issue, certainly at a department level. By the time he left office, the Department of Education not only had survived, but its budget was a factor of what it had been when he came into office. So this is a problem that is really a part of the political beast. It really defies any kind of corrective action. The phone number is 877-893-8255. 877-893-TALK. We'll not be able to get to as many calls simply because we had Mr. Jacoby on for two full segments, but those were great segments to really set forth these issues, and I really do appreciate the boldness with which he's writing. I mean, after all, Jeff Jacoby is not writing somewhere in the Bible Belt on these things. He is a columnist for the Boston Globe, folks. Just imagine what's all around him. The faculty of Harvard, Boston College, Boston University, MIT. Those people aren't going to like these arguments. Let's go to Donna calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Go ahead, Donna.
Yes, my comment about the children getting birth control, I think it's really dangerous for parents not to know what kind of medications or things their kids are taking. How can you prevent them from having side effects to things that you don't even know they're taking?
You know, Donna, that just makes perfect sense to me. And I am not a doctor. I'm not a pharmacist. But it just seems to me that if you're talking about birth control pills, you're talking about hormonal medications. given to children, girls here as young as 11, 12, and 13, I can't believe that wouldn't have an effect upon them, even on their development. I mean, even if a doctor is doing this as a parent, even if you try to bracket for a moment what these drugs are for, the very fact that the child is taking them is to me incredible. And the insanity is, of course, that this child can't take an aspirin, can't take a baby aspirin, couldn't take a placebo without parental authorization in any other circumstance. Somehow sex is all of a sudden now a protected category. Don, I want to ask you a question, and I appreciate you calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Let's just say that that right now this is something that happened in Portland, Maine. That's where it took place. Would you think that this could happen in Omaha, Nebraska?
Oh, absolutely. We're changing to where that'll happen anywhere if we don't stop it. Anything that gets started grows.
You know, Donna, that's wisdom, and that's the reason I wanted to ask the question, because there are people, I'm sure, listening to this who say, well, you know, that's the secular Northeast, that's the liberal Northeast, that's not going to happen where I am. Well, these cases, drawing so much nationwide attention, have been particularly, in recent months, attached to Massachusetts, where we had the Lexington, Massachusetts case we talked about, here in Maine, also in Minneapolis, and, of course, in California. But Donna's exactly right. What happens in one place is going to be repeated elsewhere. And this is the agenda of those who are pushing for the school-based health clinics and what's called comprehensive sex education and comprehensive health care. And let's remember, a part of the atrocity here, let's face it, I mean, what's going to get the attention of a lot of parents is we're not talking about 15, 16, and 17-year-olds. I would argue that it's immoral to give 15, 16, and 17-year-olds contraceptives without parental knowledge and parental permission. But when you're talking about 11, 12, and 13-year-olds, I think there are an awful lot of parents who, if they're listening to this, might for the first time really be awakened to what's going on here. Remember, these are the same people, we've also talked about this recently, who want to extend the reach of the public schools not only from 5-year-olds onward, but down into 3- and 4-year-olds. Right now, so far as I know, every single Democratic candidate for the nomination supports universal preschool. And you just think about what that means. If they're going to be giving contraceptives to 11, 12, and 13-year-olds, and right now, let's just be honest, it's one school we're talking about, but it's a school board action, it sets a policy and it sets a precedent. If they're going to be doing that, then just imagine, you know, what comes next. Folks, we're talking here about a very, very serious compromise and denial of parental rights. What rights do you as a parent believe that you should have? The phone number is 877-893-8255. What kind of rights would you demand as a parent over the education of your children? I'm going to suggest that one of my concerns, even out of this news story, is that there are going to be people who hear about this atrocity. And given the velocity of the news media and the swarm created about this, it's hard to believe anyone right now wouldn't know about it. But one of my concerns is that there are going to be people who are going to look at that and say, all right, I believe I should have a parental right to determine whether my child will, without my knowledge, be given contraceptives. I believe that I should have the right to make that decision. But let me tell you, when it comes to higher education, when it comes to preschool, elementary, and secondary education, it's not just what's being passed out in the health clinic that should concern parents. It's what's being passed out in the classroom in terms of worldview and ideas. So I hope, even as there are parents who are alarmed and alerted by contraceptives being given to 11, 12, and 13-year-olds, you're concerned about what's being handed them intellectually, K through 12, and beyond from there. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. I want to come back to the fact that parental rights for the education of children is an absolutely fundamental issue for a free society. And I want to hammer that here at the end. I just want us to think about this. You can't have a free society if you cannot control the education of your children. And that's exactly what's happening insofar as parents are being told, if your children are in the public schools, you do not have a right to determine what they're going to be taught. We covered this case in California, went all the way to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals at the federal court level. And turned down. We're going to be tracing this issues and tracing these incidents and tracking this issue state by state, court by court, district by district, I think for a long time, because this is going to spread from one place to another. Some people will simply say this is an acceptable price to pay in order to have government-sponsored education and the good that comes from the common school. That's obviously not my argument. As a matter of fact, I think that is a very weak and in the end, irresponsible argument. Because our responsibility as parents is, first of all, for the education of our children. We're going to give an answer to God for how we taught our children, the kinds of choices that we make, the kinds of decisions that we make concerning the education of our own children. And you have the right to make those decisions. You need to exercise that right. If you decide to send your children to the public schools, you better know what you're doing and have a plan for exactly how you're going to handle that in their lives. That's up to you. But if you make another decision, private school, Christian school, homeschool, just know that that is an exercise of your right and responsibility as parents. If we come to a time where the teachers' unions and the educational establishment have their way, you're not going to have that choice. And as a matter of fact, that's not scare language. You can look at the official policy statements of groups such as the NEA and others, and you can find tremendous hostility towards any educational option other than the public schools. And in particular, you'll find a great deal of hostility to parental involvement in terms of what is taught, how it's taught, and the entire question of education. Nothing's more important than the education of children in terms of their formation. Of course, that's bigger than the question of what school they may or may not attend. That has to do with everything they learn in the context in which they're brought up. Has to do with what happens in the family, what happens in the church, or what happens in their neighborhood, and what happens, of course, in the classroom. But parents, let's just remember, we're responsible for it all. If you would not send your child unprotected into a dangerous place, a high crime area of town, if you would not send them into a dangerous place where there are predatory animals at night wandering in the woods, would you dare send them into a place where they are prey for the battle over worldviews? Would you willingly send your kids into a place where at ages 11, 12, and 13, they can be given contraceptives without your knowledge? It's no longer a hypothetical question. It's all too real. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.